It's been already shown that the Aristotelian ideas do offer a promising alternative for the contemporary metaphysics of powers in a number of aspects. What I focus on here is just the role of some interpretation of poiesis, pathesis, identity thesis for one particular issue of metaphysics of powers, namely the nature of what Anna calls the internal transition to the activated state of a power. Since this role was widely discussed within the scholastic metaphysics of powers, I evoke some relevant scholastic debates concerning them, although I do not aim at a purely historical reconstruction here. I will proceed in three steps. First, I will present briefly some interpretation of the thesis itself. Then I will sketch the main features of Aristotelian metaphysics of powers incorporating this thesis, confronting this Aristotelian picture with some contemporary ones. And in the third part, which is the main one, I would like to show the prospects of this Aristotelian metaphysical framework within one area of metaphysics of powers, the issues of internal transition to the activated state, activation triggering of a power, power readiness for action, and so on. So the first part, the poiesis, pathesis, identity thesis in the third book of physics. Suppose the fire hits some water in a pot. Then we can make three plausible claims. I think we need no special argument for them. They do not need to be proved. First is that it's precisely one and the same temperature change that the fire causes and the water undergoes. In this sense, the motion of the agent and the motion of the patient are one and the same motion. Just because the motion of the agent is the motion caused by the agent, and the motion of the patient is something the patient undergoes. I will call this claim motion identity thesis. Then if you describe the situation in terms of exercises or fulfillments of powers, that is in terms of energeia, it's precisely one and the same temperature change that is the exercise or fulfillment of the fire's heating power and of the water's relevant liability. It is the exercise of the agent power insofar as it is caused by the agent, by its power, and it is the exercise of the patient liability insofar as the patient undergoes it. I will call this claim exercise identity thesis. I think there is some important difference between what I've said and the analysis presented by Anna in her 2007 paper on the union of cause and effect in Aristotle. She says that the kinesis grounding both the poiesis and pathesis is just, I quote, the movements of the sculptor's arms and chisel on the wood. Quotation end. It seems to me, however, that the kinesis in question is rather the very change of the shape of the wood. That is precisely this change, the change of shape, that grounds chiseling on one hand and being chiseled on the other. I will return to this issue later. Well, the third claim is that heating is precisely causing a temperature change, whereas being heated is precisely undergoing the temperature change. Now, with having stated these three claims, we may ask what precisely is the relationship between the temperature change itself and heating, which is causing the change in question, and being heated, which is undergoing that change. Now, according to the Poiesis Pathesis identity thesis, on one hand, the change itself, as far as it is an exercise of the heating power, is heating. That change is heating. On the other hand, the change itself, as far as it is an exercise of the relevant liability of water, is being heated. In other words, one and the same change is an exercise both of the heating power and of the water liability. As the exercise of the heating power, the change is heating, and as the exercise of the water liability, the same change is being heated. In general terms, one and the same kinesis taking place in the subject of change is both a pathesis and a poiesis, because it is both the exercise of the active and the passive power that are engaged. I think the reason for accepting the identity thesis is precisely the following. Heating is the exercise of the heating power, and being heated is the exercise of the relevant liability. But one and the same change is the exercise of both the power and the liability. So one and the same change, being the single exercise of the two, is both a poiesis and a pathesis. So the crucial point in the argument, as I see it, is the idea of exercise identity, or more precisely of something, one and the same motion, change, being the common exercise of a number of powers. At the same time, however, this exercise identity is rather, to use Anna Marmodoro's words, a qualified sameness, and Aristotle is at pains, mainly in his Aporia Logicae in physics, to show more precisely how this qualified sameness is to be understood, for it has to be compatible with some sort of a real distinction between poiesis and pathesis, as exercises of essentially distinct powers. I agree with Anna that there is a real and essential difference between poiesis and pathesis, and not just a difference of description of one and the same event. In other words, the exercise identity thesis should be accepted in some qualified sense only. So, for example, one may think, as Anna suggests, that when you say that the temperature change is both the action and that it is the patient, what you have here is something like the is of material constitution and not the is of identity. To sum up, I think there are two layers in the Aristotelian treatment of poiesis, pathesis, identity in physics. On one hand, there are some fundamental intuitions that hardly need to be proved. They are expressed in motion identity thesis and in the exercise identity thesis. On the other hand, there is something that needs clarifying but proves notoriously difficult to clarify. It is the sort of qualified sameness of exercise that is compatible with a real and essential difference between poiesis and pathesis. Or, in other words, it is the qualified sense in which identity of exercise thesis should be accepted. To clarify this, you may say, for example, that is in the kinesis is the poiesis, and the is the is of material constitution as opposed to the is of identity. That's the way of Anna's paper. I think you may get some general idea of this qualified sameness in question, of the qualified sense of the exercise identity thesis, in the two other ways too. They I think shed some light on the problem of this qualified sameness. The first is this. It is true that one and the same temperature change is the exercise of both the heating power and the water's relevant liability. But the change is the exercise of the heating power as heating and not as being heated. One and the same change is both heating and being heated, but it is the exercise of the heating power as heating and not as being heated. So in particular, there is some sense in which the temperature change is not the exercise of the heating power. There is some aspect in which the temperature change is not the exercise of the heating power. More generally, one and the same kinesis, maybe both F and G, that is, have distinct aspects expressed by the predicates F and G, and it may be the exercise of a given power as F, but not as G. One and the same kinesis has various aspects expressed by various predicates which are true of it, and it's always in a given respect only, in a respect expressed by a given predicate, that the kinesis is the exercise of a given power. It is not an exercise of the power in question in many other aspects expressed by various other predicates. By the way, it may be interesting to note that there is a close connection between the qualified sense of the exercise identity thesis, which I sketch here, and Anscombe's thesis that an action is voluntary always under some description. Anscombe's thesis says that something is an exercise of will under some description, and the exercise identity thesis, in the qualified sense, says that something is an exercise of any power, just in some respect which is expressed by some predicate true of it. So at least in some interpretation, Anscombe's thesis is just a particular case of the general suggestion concerning power exercises I present here. Another way to grasp the problems of qualified sameness of exercise would be the following. In case of heating, you have one and the same temperature change and two essentially distinct ways in which it belongs to the relevant powers. In other words, two essentially distinct sorts of relationship between a power and its exercise or manifestation. In case of fire and its heating power, the relationship consists in the fact that the change is caused by the fire. And in case of water and its liability, the relevant relationship consists in the fact that the change affects the water or takes place in the water. Now, this suggests the following picture. The difference between the manifestations of the active power of fire and the passive power of water does not consist in, so to say, the content of the manifestations, which is the temperature change, one and the same in both cases, but rather in the ways the change belongs to the two sorts of powers. So, two things are essential for the given power. On one hand, there is the change, which is its manifestation, but on the other hand, there is the specific way in which it is a manifestation of the power in question, the specific sort of relationship between the power and its manifestation. So one and the same thing may be a manifestation of two essentially distinct sorts of powers because it may be a manifestation of these powers in two essentially distinct ways which are determined by the natures of that powers. So the difference between the manifestations then is not a difference of, so to say, the content of the manifestation, but the way of belonging, that content to the power. It is a manifestation of. This corresponds roughly with the idea put forward, for example, by Handfield, that what the manifestation of a power consists in is not just a kind of event, but also the specific causal process that produces it. He says, I quote, "When salt manifests its disposition to dissolve, for instance, it seems not merely to involve an initial state in which the salt is solid and a final state in which it is dissolved. Rather, it's important that salt undergo a distinctive kind of causal process. If the salt solution came about by a deviant process, we might say that the salt was not manifesting its disposition to dissolve." This corresponds also to the idea of Aquinas that the exercise identity should be expressed in the terms used in abstracto as opposed to the in concreto terms. For the difference between a term in concreto and the same term in abstracto is just that the former incorporates somehow in what it designates the relationship to the subject, and the latter does not. So he claims, commenting on some passage from the third book of Physics, that it's true that actio and passio are one and the same, but agere and pati are not, because verbs, as opposed to nouns, should be interpreted as terms in concreto. It's worth noting, by the way, that Aquinas offers a concise treatise concerning predication theory in general and categories, just in his commentary on the poiesis pathesis identity thesis in Physics. Such a treatment of the issue of predication proves necessary to show that there is some real difference between action and passion, and not just a difference of description. So that is the end of my part one, which is presentation of the thesis itself. Now, very briefly, some features of metaphysics of powers incorporating this thesis. If you consider an ontology of powers which includes poiesis pathesis identity thesis in some version, there are at least four points at which it contrasts with some contemporary ontologies of powers. The first point, in the Aristotelian picture, there is a common manifestation or exercise of active and passive powers. That is the point of exercise identity thesis, although it should be accepted only in some qualified sense. This contrasts clearly with Molnar's standpoint. Although Molnar admits common, that is polygenic, effects of powers, he thinks that manifestations, which are power contributions to effect as opposed to effects themselves, that manifestations are not polygenic and cannot be common to distinct powers. And in Physics, I think in some sense you have a common manifestation. The second point, in the Aristotelian picture, there is not a sharp distinction between effects and manifestations. This contrasts again with Molnar's ontology of powers. For Molnar, effects are not manifestations of powers in any sense. This point has been criticized, for example, by McKittrick in Manifestations as Effects. In the Aristotelian picture, it's the very temperature change that is the manifestation or exercise of the heating power. More precisely, it is the manifestation of the heating power as heating in some respect, but it is not the manifestation of the heating power as being heated in some other respect. More generally, one and the same effect, which is both F and G, may be the manifestation of a given power as F, but not a manifestation of that power as G. third point is that in the Aristotelian picture there are at least some cases in which contributions of powers do not combine or are not composed to produce the effect. This contrasts again with Molnar. He thinks that it is an important general question, what is it for power contributions to combine, to be composed? And he suggests in his horses pulling a barge example that there is something like vector addition involved here. This idea is developed by Mumford and Anium in getting causes from powers. Now, in the Aristotelian picture, hitting and being hitted are clearly not combined to produce a single effect. One thing is especially worth noting here. Following some Aristotelian examples of routes with opposite directions and the same road, Anna Marmodoro suggests that in some respect action and passion are like vectors. Now, it's clear that vector addition itself is not a part of this analogy, for a result of vector addition in this case would be just zero. And the last point, there is also, however, a contrast between the Aristotelian picture and the ideas of mutual manifestation. There is a contrast in that, as Anna has shown, you may have in the Aristotelian picture mutual or common manifestation and preserve some kind of asymmetry between active and passive powers. But there is also, I think, some other contrast. The Aristotelian criteria of unity of the motion, which is a common exercise of distinct powers, are quite strong. So you can say, what is it that is the common manifestation? What it is that is the same in the manifestations of distinct powers? And it seems that for Aristotle, you cannot just say it's their partnering, it's their working together, which is the same. You have some independent criterion of unity of this common manifestation. It seems to me that they are considerably weaker in Martin. There is also a discussion on the criteria of working together for powers in a symposium on getting causes from powers. There is a question asked by Anna about the criteria of working together, what makes power work together, and it seems that these criteria are pretty weak ones. Exerting some force or some influence on the same subject of change is said to be enough for a real cooperation of powers. Here this identity or unity criteria of the common manifestation are far more strong, I think. To sum up, I think there is clearly a common core of all these differences. The main problem is that in a standard case of power manifestation, you have on one hand a common effect, or even in some qualified sense a common exercise, a common manifestation, and on the other hand you have the plurality of contribution or of causal roles. The question is, what precisely is the relationship between the unity of common effect and the plurality of contributions or causal roles? And in particular, whether there is any sort of addition or composition of contributions, the common effect being their sum in any way. Now, the question how the sameness of poiesis and pathesis has to be qualified is precisely the same issue, and the Aristotelian tradition offers some interesting and insightful answers here. Now I begin my third and main part, that's the problem of activation of powers. The main question I would like to address here is the following. What does precisely happen to a power when it is triggered or exercised? What is this internal transition to the activated state, to use Anna's words, for the power itself? Is this transition a real change, as opposed to a Cambridge one, of the power itself, or not? In general, I think the answer is that it depends on the kind of power in question. I think a form of dispositional pluralism is quite plausible here. Now, to go into some details, it will be convenient to divide the subject. So first I will focus on the question whether the very exercise or manifestation of the power is a real change of the power. Then I will proceed to the other question whether triggering the power, whatever it may consist in, is a real change of the power itself. So what is it for a power to be exercised? Is it a real change of the power when it begins its exercise? We have to begin with a distinction of two kinds of powers. On one hand, there are powers which have, to use Anna formulations, ectopic or displaced realizations. They are causal powers in a narrow sense used by Jonathan Low, powers whose exercise or manifestation is causing other things to change or to do something. The poiesis pathesis identity thesis holds immediately for the manifestation of this sort of powers. On the other hand, there are non-causal powers in Low's sense, powers whose manifestations or exercises are immanent actions in the scholastic sense. Low's examples comprise a power to roll, possessed in virtue of spherical shape, a power to undergo radioactive decay, as well as the power of will exercised in volitions. Scholastic examples of immanent actions comprised the acts of the powers of sight and other senses, the power of reason, the power of will. In case of a doctor applying some treatment to himself, we have an exercise of the causal power, the object of which happens to be the subject of the active power. There is some accidental identity of the agent and the patient. But the active power is not the principle of undergoing change or being cured. So curing oneself is not an immanent action in the strict sense. The point is made, for example, by Suarez in its relevant quotation in the handout. What you need for immanent action in a strict sense is the identity of the power that causes the action and the power that receives the action. So let us now return to the main question. What is it for a power to be exercised? Or, in other words, what is the internal transition of the power to the activated state? I will present the answers for two kinds of powers. First, non-causal powers. In case of non-causal powers having immanent actions as their exercises, the answer seems relatively simple. There are two sorts of relationship between such a power and its exercise or manifestation. On one hand, the manifestation is caused or produced by the power. On the other hand, the manifestation of the power takes place in the subject of the power, or even in the power itself. To use a classical example, a volition as a manifestation of the power of will is, on one hand, something produced by the will, And on the other hand, it is something taking place in the subject of the will, and even, as it's usually said, in the power of will itself. So what you have here is the identity of producing power and receiving power, the identity which is lacking in the example of the doctor curing himself. Such powers were taken to be both active and passive at the same time. It is their essential feature that their exercise is not only something produced by them, but also something taking place in them. So producing the change, such powers undergo the change at the same time. So in this case, the transition to the activated state is a real change of the power itself. And the reason to accept this is the identity of power having two sorts of relationship with its exercise at the same time, or having both the active and passive character. As far as causal powers with ectopic realizations are concerned, the issue becomes more complicated, and there is a lively scholastic debate about it, even within the Thomistic camp. So I would like to sketch briefly two main standpoints in the debate. The first, which may be called, I think, standard interpretation of the third book of physics, and is embraced, for example, by Suarez, is the following. In case of displaced realization, the action of the active power is to be identified with the change taking place in the passive subject. So the exercise of the causal powers takes place beyond them and is at best a Cambridge change of the active power itself, and in no way a real change. So when a causal power begins to have its effect, actually, nothing at all happens to the power itself. From this point of view, having actually its effect, it's comparable to being actually considered, or being actually remembered, or being actually seen. That is the analogy which is often evoked. You have it in two quotations from Antonio Rubio and from the College of Carmelites in point 312a. So, for example, nothing, literally nothing, happens to the heating fire when water becomes hot. It is water that is changed and not the fire. So, according to this standpoint, there is no such thing as the internal transition to the activated state in case of causal powers. Or more precisely, that transition to the activated state is at best a Cambridge change, because there is no real difference between the potential and the activated state of the power. There is, of course, and Suarez admits that there is, some connection between the temperature change of the water and the fire. It is in virtue of such a connection that the water is heated just by this fire as opposed to any other one. The point is that this connection may occur and not occur without any real change in the fire. So when such a connection begins to obtain, it all happens beyond the fire itself. There is also a useful distinction made by Suarez in context of this standpoint. It is the distinction of subjectum predicationis and subjectum inhesionis. The subjectum predicationis is the thing, something expressed by the predicate may be truly ascribed to. And the subjectum inhesionis is the thing in which something expressed by the predicate inheres. So the subjectum predicationis of the action, like heating, is the thing the action may be truly ascribed to. It is, for example, the fire and its heating power. On the other hand, the subjectum inhesionis of the action like heating is the thing in which the action inheres. Now, as far as the action is to be identified with temperature change, it inheres in the water and not in the fire. One may add that it does not inhere in the water as action, but only as a change or as passion. So Suarez claims that the action, like heating, just as an action, has no subjectum inhesionis at all. There is no subject in which it inheres as action, although there is a subject in which it inheres as a change, but in no sense it inheres in the agent or in the active powers. That is, I think, an interesting example of divergence between subjectum inhesionis and subjectum predicationis, but it is by no means the only one. So the device is not invented to deal just with this problem. A traditional scholastic example could be the ringing bell. It is the bell that ringing or sounding are truly ascribed to. So it is the bell that is the subjectum predicationis of ringing, sounding, of sound. But a question about the subjectum inhesionis, the question what is the thing that the sound inheres, is a non-trivial one, and one that was much discussed. To sum up, it seems to me that the standpoint of Suarez is a good reading of what is said in the third book of Physics. Yet there is one weak point in it. It seems that it's a key feature of the very concept of agency, that what an agent does, his action, has to be opposed to what just happens to it. Now, on Suarez's account, the action seems something quite external to the agent, something that happens to it even without any real change in the agent, in the active power. In other words, the objection would be that on Suarezian account, the action itself is a matter of something going on beyond the agent. The most natural way of response to such an objection would be admitting that actions like heating, that actions which are ectopic or displaced realizations, are very poor examples of agency at all, and that you have agency in a stronger or a more proper sense, together with a contrast between things that the agent does and things that merely happen to it, only in case of immanent actions. And volitions would be the most appealing examples of immanent actions. Volitions and immanent actions in general do have external effects, but it is the immanent actions that make causing the external effects examples of agency in a full-blown sense. John of St. Thomas rejects this sort of response by maintaining that the essential difference between immanent action and actions like heating is not located in the activity of the agent, but rather on the part of the effects of that action. But it's a real question, I think, whether immanent actions and actions like heating, actions with ectopic realizations, are actions, are examples of agency in the same sense. So that's all I wanted to say about the first standpoint, about this standard interpretation of Aristotle. There is also, however, another standpoint, even within the Thomistic tradition, represented by prominent Thomists like Cardinal Thomas de Vio or John of St. Thomas. A According to this standpoint, besides the action, which is to be identified in some way with the change and with the passion, that is, besides the ectopic realization of a causal power, there is also something inhering in the power itself whenever it is exercised. It is just this entity inhering in the power that makes the internal transition to the activated state a real change of the power. And it is just this entity inhering in the power that grants a real difference between the power's activated state and the potential one. Surely there is no mention of such an entity in the third book of physics. This absence is explained, for example, by John of St. Thomas, by saying that Aristotle's interest in physics was not focused on this aspect of agency, of causing motion, but rather on the motion itself, and on the action only insofar as it is, as it may be identified in some way with the motion. The Thomists usually stress that the entity inhering in the agent is not just a relation to the action. The idea that the action inhering in the agent is the relation to the action is recognized as the scotistic standpoint. I think there are two main ideas that can justify this standpoint. The first is that going into action, or a transition from inactivity to activity, from standing by to acting, all these things as such just have to be some real changes of the agent, of the active power. They may be pretty peculiar sort of change, but they must be real changes. In other words, what makes an agent actually busy with something, actually engaged in causing something, must be something in the agent and not in the effect. The other idea is that the action that may be identified with the change is the action performed or caused by the agent. In Latin, actio effecta. But it seems that besides the action performed or caused by the agent, there must be still something else in the agent, namely the agent's performing or causing that action. Latin, actio efficiens. And it seems that whereas the actio effecta, the action that is caused, might be ectopic, displaced and identified in some way with the change in the patient, the actio efficiens performing or causing that action must inhere in the agent and cannot be identified with the change in patient. One may think that actio efficiens is a source of basic action as opposed to actio effecta. Suarez seems to think so when he rejects this distinction of action which is caused by an agent and action which is just causing the former action. But John of St. Thomas, for example, says that both actions do come immediately from the agent. So one of them is not more basic action than the other. So in these two ways, I think you may establish the thesis that there is an internal transition to the state of activation, even in case of causal powers with ectopic realizations. It amounts, I think, to an important weakening of the Aristotelian poiesis pathesis identity thesis. It also clearly introduces something that is absent in the very Aristotelian treatment in the third book of Physics. It seems, moreover, that John of St. Thomas' standpoint opens a possibility of trying to cause something without any ectopic realization, that is, without any effect at all. That such a quite ineffective trying is possible in case of voluntary actions, that I might try to raise my arm and nothing at all happens in my body, is one of key arguments for volitions. It was discussed in scholasticism whether there might be such a quite ineffective trying in case of non-voluntary causal agency. For example, if it's possible that fire tries to hit something and nothing at all happens in the thing it tries to hit. And John's standpoint seems close to the idea that there may be, so that actio efficiens, which is postulated as inhering in the agent, is a counterpart of volition in a non-voluntary causal action. Now the last part of my talk, that is the problem of triggering. I proceed to the question whether triggering of a power is causing a real change in the power itself. First, I will consider some cases in which the answer seems to be negative. Then I will focus on some cases in which I think triggering a power is causing some internal change in that power. This will involve some application of what I have said about qualified sameness of exercise of various powers to the issues of power readiness for action and power directedness towards a given sort of manifestation. So to begin with, there seems to be a wide group of examples in which triggering a power is not causing any real change in the power itself. This is the case, it seems, when triggering a power to produce a given response, it is just arranging some context in which the power produces just this sort of response. It may consist, in particular, by introducing some new power, the contribution of which makes the power produce that response. In the simple example of heating the water in a pot, you make the fire heat some water, as opposed to, say, some milk or some petrol, just by putting water and not milk or anything else in the fire's vicinity. It seems clear that in such cases, the powers we introduce do modify the action of the power, but not the power itself. The power is characterized by what it would do being placed in various circumstances. It is precisely this point, I think, that is made by Martin and Hale in the quotation in the handout. A disposition can be fully present and ready to go, yet never manifest itself. There, that is, reciprocal disposition partners' absence or non-existence does not affect the readiness of dispositional state. That state need not change in any way to be manifested. The same point may be made in terms of the poiesis pathesis identity thesis by saying that the temperature change is a change of water because it takes place in the water, and that the change is not an exercise of heating power as a change of water. In other words, the object of the fire's heating activity is determined by the water and its relevant liability, but not by the fire's heating power. And the fact that the heating power in question is directed towards water as opposed to milk or anything else is a matter of an arrangement which is external to the heating power. So, in these cases, triggering a power is not causing any change in the power itself. It seems, however, that there are also cases in which triggering a power is causing some internal change in the power. In this change, the power acquires the directedness towards a given sort of exercise or manifestation which it had not before. And in this sense, it becomes ready for a sort of action it was not ready for before. It is an internal transition to the state of readiness for a given sort of exercise. In a scholastic jargon, this sort of change used to be called constitutio in actu primo. The actus primus is just an immediate readiness for a given sort of exercise, which is actus secundus. The main scholastic example of this kind of triggering a power and making it ready for a given sort of exercise is the action of an external sense power triggered by the action of the sensible object exerted upon the sense or the sense organ. To see the reason for this, let's note first that on the Aristotelian account, the intentional object of the act of seeing is determined by some influence of what we perceive. What I see is a red circle because the red circle of the traffic lights exerts some influence upon my power of sight. The problem is precisely whether this determination does work like the determination of the object of heating in case of fire and water, or it requires some different mechanism of determination. It seems clear, first of all, that seeing the red circle is unlike hitting the water precisely in the following aspect. Hitting the water is doing something with the water, and being an ectopic realization takes place in the water. But seeing the red circle is not doing something with the red circle, and does not take place in the red circle. So, at least in this sense, the determination of the object cannot be exactly similar in case of the object of hitting and the object of seeing. There is, however, another way of securing the similarity there. It is suggested by Aristotle himself and adopted by some scholastic, for example, by Gyrus of Rome. You may think that the proper counterpart of the power of sight is not the hitting power of fire, but rather the relevant liability of water. Then it seems that the determination of the object of seeing resembles the determination of the heating object. The water is heated by fire and not by some other heating factor because it is fire and not some other factor that is in the water vicinity and exerts some influence upon water. Similarly, one may think what I see is a red circle because it's a red circle that exerts some influence upon my power of sight. This sort of assimilation is strongly suggested by Aristotelian application of the poiesis pathesis identity thesis to the case of perception. He treats sensible object as a subject of the active power which exerts some influence upon the passive power of the sense. If one accepts this assimilation, the consequence is that seeing is just being changed by the sensible object. I think, however, that there are good reasons to reject this sort of assimilation. Seeing is rather an immanent action and not just passion or ectopic realization of the active power of the sensible object. So the fact that the object of my seeing is just the red circle cannot be accounted for by the fact that it's the red circle that exerts some influence upon my sight. One may try to treat this case in the way suggested by the Martin Hale quotation. So, for example, one may say that it's grounded in the very nature of the power of sight that it produces an act of seeing red circle when a red circle is in the visual field. But if we assume that the red circle triggers the power without causing any real change in it, this account seems unconvincing. It works well for powers with ectopic realization just because these realizations are ectopic, are displaced. They take place beyond the powers and so may be modified without any internal change in the dispositional state itself, as Martin and Hale say. Here, however, the activity of the power of sight is not an ectopic realization. It takes place in the power of sight. So it may seem strange that the very presence of the red circle determines the intentional object of seeing. This, I think, shows some plausibility in the standpoint widely accepted in late scholasticism, that the sensible object causes some real change in the power of sight. That change is becoming ready for the activity with a given intentional object. What a power acquires in such a kind of triggering is a readiness for a given sort of action with a given intentional object. It is a readiness that the power did not have before. So I would conclude that in some cases there are special reasons to think that triggering a power is making it ready for some sort of action and is some internal change of the power itself. To sum up, I think it may be quite controversial whether in case of causal powers with ectopic realization there is a real change in them being the transition to the activated state. I'm inclined to embrace Suarez's standpoint here. On the other hand, in case of triggering of some powers whose exercises are immanent actions, it seems reasonable that there is some internal change in the triggered power, a change in which that power becomes ready for some action it was not ready before.